The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whey protein shakes, performance energy bars, cookies and cream-flavored muscle milk. Sports nutrition is a multi-billion dollar market in the U.S., crowding grocery aisles and drugstores with expensive products engineered to replenish athletes before and after workouts. A new study from the University of Montana puts some of these products to the test against an unlikely opponent. Mickey D's. The study found that when it comes to the best post-workout recovery meals, a McDonald's Big Mac and a Coke may be just as good as a protein bar and a Gatorade. Brent Ruby is an exercise physiologist. He's an avid endurance athlete, and he's behind the study, which was published in the International Journal of Sports Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism. Brent, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what motivated this study?
Well, there's a whole host of products marketed to the athlete, and the athlete I use loosely. It could be the recreational athlete, it could be the endurance athlete, it could be a strength or a power athlete. And so a lot of these products have grown up around those kind of exercise habits. So we were very interested in trying to challenge that by picking items about as far on the other end of the spectrum as some of these marketed products.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the study. How was it conducted?
So what we did was and this is a common protocol, we've done this quite a bit with different athletes, looking at muscle carbohydrate restoration or replenishment. And so in order to do that, you have to take all that out of the muscle. So we give them a hard 90-minute exercise trial on the bike, and then we take a muscle sample. That's evaluated for the glycogen content within that sample. And then we feed them one meal, and 2 hours later we feed them a second meal. At the four-hour mark, take another muscle sample, and then we put them back on that same bike and they do a performance trial, which is like a 20-kilometer time trial.
Mm-hmm. So a pretty hearty workout, but you fed some of these men McDonald's meals, hotcakes, hash browns, orange juice, or what else?
So under the two different feeding windows, the first feeding was either Gatorade, a Kitz Organic Power Bar, or Clif Shot Blocks. And that was matched head-to-head with the McDonald's small orange juice, pancakes, and a hash brown.
Hmm.
And then 2 hours later, they had a liquid feeding of a product called Cytomax. They had a power bar recovery bar and some power bar energy chews to match calorie for calorie. But the McDonald's menu the second time around, because of the time of day, had to be there within their lunch menu. And we were very conservative with what we chose. We had to be. So it's a small French fry, a small regular hamburger, not a Big Mac, mm-hmm. but a small regular hamburger, and a medium Coke.
Okay, so were you measuring, and what did you find?
We took blood samples to look at blood sugar, blood insulin levels. In the muscle samples, we were looking at our main metric, which is muscle glycogen, which is the carbohydrate fuel within the muscle. And we want to see that come back up because that's predictive of recovery.
And was there any discernible difference between those who ate the quote-unquote athletic recovery meals and the McDonald's meals?
There were no differences between the two trials. So the blood parameters looked identical. Exercise performance was no different. And it's also important to note that the same subjects did both trials. So we don't just have one group getting this and one group getting this. the one group of 11 guys came in twice. And that brings with it quite a bit more statistical power.
Yeah. What, Brent, is the purpose of a recovery meal, and what is typically recommended as a good example of recovery meals?
90% of the time, a recovery menu can be a piece of fruit and some water and maybe a yogurt or something really simple like that, because people haven't really drained the muscle fully or taken the muscle to a level that they really have to focus intently on getting calories in or specific calories in that 30-minute or four-hour window afterwards. In the other 10% of the time when people are really going hard like these guys did, then it is important to try to start putting some calories back into the tank. And the two most important things is obviously an adequate amount of carbohydrate and a better source of protein, like a complete protein source. That helps stimulate muscle growth and muscle maintenance. And so it's really a fuel and a muscle maintenance focus.
Okay, so they got a little carbs, a little protein, a little fat. But fast food, especially McDonald's, has been criticized, of course, as being high in saturated fat, additives, and preservatives. Is this something that an athlete could sustain over the long term?
I mean, you have to take these results cautiously, because menu items from McDonald's are not every menu item from McDonald's. I mean, you have to focus only on the foods that we consumed, because you can certainly go overboard with any fast food product.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but if you pair certain things within their menu, this is just one of many possible combinations that would work adequately. So we're not saying do this all the time, but there are definitely times when that might be the only option. And if it's your only option...
Well, this, of course, flies in the face of everything we're told about healthy and unhealthy diets by critics of fast foods and nutritionists. Any danger here of condoning eating at McDonald's? Are you worried about that at all in the results of this study?
I'm not worried about that, really. I mean, if people really focus on the true results of this study, and I think most of the messages out there that have been characterized by this study have done a pretty good job, although one publication said... The tagline was, "Doctors say fried chicken is good for you."
Mm.
I'm like, wow, that's not even close to what we did. But, I mean, people misconstrue everything within science. The real message is that it's not necessarily critical what you choose to eat afterwards, just that you get something.
Mm.
So the results of this study don't give you a free pass to fast food. What's really important to consider that physical activity is far more important than the diets that we choose.
Mm.
Those have a much more profound effect on our overall health and fitness. And I always liken it to the Lewis and Clark expedition. When they came through the nastiest part of Montana, they weren't doing well, but they were doing what they were doing, eating candles and horse meat.
Okay, so I'm not necessarily going to be seeing you at the drive-thru next time I'm there, huh, Brent?
No, I don't use the drive-thru. I always go in.
You get more exercise that way. Brent Ruby, thank you for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Brent Ruby, he's an exercise physiologist at the University of Montana. He's a former Ironman triathlete, and he's a researcher. He was behind a study that discovered that when it comes to workout recovery meals, calorie splurges at McDonald's, if carefully chosen, might be just as effective as expensive energy bars and protein shakes. You can find out more about his study at wordofmouthradio.org. When you think tough workout, treadmills, free weights, and the drudgery of the gym may come to mind, but burning calories doesn't have to be a chore. Ideally, it can be downright fun. When Joy Jones was looking to get back into shape, she turned to a childhood pastime, and she's attracted a following. Every Friday, people gather at a local recreation center in Washington, D.C. for some good old-fashioned Double Dutch. Andrew Hiller brings us the story.
In Double Dutch, two ropes are spun simultaneously while the jumper tries to time their leaps, skips, or tricks without getting tripped up. Joy Jones leads the adult Double Dutch group. She explains how she reconnected with the schoolyard pastime.
The thing that came first was too much weight around my hips and my stomach. That's what came first. And I was looking for ways to get rid of it. And I like exercising, but even more than exercising, I like to play. And double Dutch is a way to play and be fit all at the same time. So the traditional adult exercises, they were good, but the opportunity to revisit my childhood, that was even greater.
For many jumpers, Joan says relearning double Dutch quickly becomes old rope.
For those who jumped double Dutch as kids, once they get in the rope, the rhythm comes back and it's like riding a bike, you don't forget. Then we have those adults who never did it as kids and they're a little bit apprehensive. But when they see people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, sometimes even older, jumping rope, how can you not expect to be able to do it yourself? And it usually takes us about 10 minutes before somebody's jumping if they've never jumped before.
Some not only jump, they take command.
Faster.
Turn around.
Back up a little bit. Faster. Faster. Faster.
Terrain Bonneau drives in all the way from Alexandria just to be a part of the group.
I get bored easily, and I was actually looking out this opportunity. I kept looking in the city paper. I kept looking on Craigslist to see, you know, activity partners, if anyone was doing this in the city. I'm not doing it to burn a particular amount of calories. I'm not doing it to, you know, jump for a particular amount of time. I'm really here just to have fun, and I brought a couple friends with me as well. You know, just to kind of be somewhat nostalgic, and this is what we were doing when we were younger, and we get to do it again in our 30s.
When you think of jump roping, often you think of the ladies. Mm-hmm. Is there a stigma that you had to overcome to be a part of this?
Definitely. Don't notice it now as an adult. I guess, you know, there are a couple guys there, but as a kid, definitely. I started jumping when I was in the fifth grade, I think. Never really was into the whole basketball during recess, any of that. So I think, you know, some girls just asked me, hey, you want to try this? And I kind of got hooked.
Tamika Washington says that adult double Dutch is a lot of fun. And it's really good exercise.
It's definitely very engaging with the cardio, getting the heart rate going, and it's fun. And so, and plus you see it just like you see cheerleading now being accepted as a sport with competitions, double Dutch has competitions because it's serious. I take it very seriously.
And while jumping may be serious business, Washington says that double Dutch is not just about the jumper. It's also about the people with their hands on the ropes.
A lot of people, they take for granted the turners. The turners are very important because if you have bad turners, then that can really mess up your jump. So because I don't mind turning at all because there's an art to turning. I don't think a lot of people understand that because you have to watch that person's feet. Because for those people who aren't really confident, they may slow up or slow down. And to the average person who isn't paying attention as turning, the rope will just mess up. But if you're really paying attention to what the jumper is doing as a turner, then you can go with them and keep the rope going for as long as they can.
While the adult double Dutch at Turkey Thicket is for everyone, Joy Jones also leads the DC Retro Jumpers, a group that performs more advanced jumping feats.
We do what's called a pop-up, where you jump up high in the sky and come back in step. We bob and weave, where several people are in the rope, and we wind our ways around one another. We even have one trick where two jumpers hand dance in the rope. That means they're doing a partnered dance while jumping in the rope. And then we have another trick where a member can jump the rope double Dutch while at the same time jumping a single rope all at once.
The jumping can get complicated, but most to Turkey Thicket come for a simpler reason. Josephine Morris Young.
Yes, and that's why we do it just for fun. There are groups out there who are more professional and serious about it, but we do it for the fun and the exercise. And when we mess up, we don't consider it as a mess up. We consider it as a pause, and we laugh, and sometimes we do really silly things that make the group laugh because it's a stress reliever, too. I mean, we all work high-stressful jobs, and this kind of relieves the stress, so that laughter always helps.
So at the end of double Dutch jump roping, do they ever get double Dutch chocolate?
At the end of double Dutch jump roping, we're pretty much tired. That's about it.
So the exercise is the treat. No,
yes.
Sweets out.
That's correct.
It is an exercise in rhythm, cooperation, and a few giggles. Hoping not to trip up on my lines, I'm Andrew Hiller.
If
you've ever seen a doctor for a mysterious illness, they've probably asked you about symptoms and followed up with blood and other diagnostic tests. Well, up next, word of mouth looks at a different way to diagnose diseases. Sniffing, the smell of sickness, after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Diagnosing diseases generally begins with experience, followed by blood tests, x-rays, scans, pokes, and prods, hopefully leading beyond the symptoms to the sickness. Medical technology has become a tool for narrowing options quickly and precisely, but one powerful and accurate diagnostic tool is available to most everybody and has been used to identify diseases for centuries. The nose. Anna Rothschild is a science journalist and producer and host of the new PBS video series Gross Science. A recent episode revealed the fascinating clues some diseases give off in the form of familiar scents. And Anna, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when did doctors and nurses begin using scent to diagnose illnesses?
So people have actually been diagnosing illnesses using scent since the time of Hippocrates, so really, really long ago in ancient Greece.
Some of the smell-emitting diseases that you mentioned in your video are typhoid, smells like freshly baked brown bread. Someone with yellow fever is said to smell like a butcher shop. What are some of the others?
Yeah, so some that I think are really interesting are that diabetes is said to either smell like overripe fruit or acetone, and rubella is said to smell like freshly plucked feathers, which I guess is a little bit of an outdated one, since I don't really know what freshly plucked feathers smell like anymore.
Well, is it just diseases that involve bacteria and viruses that create a smell?
Absolutely not. So metabolic diseases can actually make you smell different ways as well. So there's a disease called maple syrup urine disease, which can be fatal if it's untreated. And like the name suggests, it makes you smell like maple syrup. But then there are other diseases like trimethylaminuria. They're not particularly dangerous. They don't have any symptoms, except that this one makes you smell like rotten fish.
Do scientists understand why certain diseases give off a, sounds like, very specific scent?
It depends on each particular disease. With something like diabetes, for example, making you smell like acetone, they know that your body is breaking down, in that case, fatty acids, and a byproduct of that metabolism, of that process, is acetone, so nail polish remover, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But in other cases, no, they don't know exactly why a certain disease produces a certain odor.
Well, you said that these have been used for millennia, it sounds like. Can healthcare workers actually be trained to use their noses to more effectively diagnose diseases?
Yeah, they can. And actually, on top of that, there are new techniques using something called e-noses, where not only can the health worker use their own nose to sniff out a disease, but they can also use a device called an e-nose, which can detect very, very faint traces of odor causing particles that the human nose wouldn't be able to pick up.
That's fascinating. So something that they'll hold up near you and it sniffs you, basically?
Exactly. It's kind of like, you can sort of think of it as like a breathalyzer, except it's analyzing you for diseases rather than alcohol.
Now, we've heard and talked on this program, actually, about the ability of dogs to sniff out cancer or certain cancers. And C. diff, a gut disease, is that kind of what it's doing?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think that still today, dogs are excellent at doing that. Though one of the things that people worry about with dogs sniffing out things like cancer is that they're not sure how specific the dogs can be. So say a dog indicates that you have a type of cancer. It's still not entirely clear if the dog will know exactly what type of cancer you have. So people are still sort of working on that. But it's a very similar idea with the e-nose, where this e-nose could be used to detect cancer or tuberculosis or, you know, other types of infections like that.
It's just amazing to think of. I mean, I love the idea of an e-nose being held up to you and telling you what's going on. It's non-invasive, certainly. It sounds quick. But how about accuracy? Is there a danger of false positives or false negatives with an e-nose?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, certainly. And a lot of these are still prototypes. I'm not sure if these are really being used in clinical practices to a large extent yet. But one of the really great things that I think the future of e-noses that could be really cool is taking e-noses that are handheld and portable out to places in the developing world mm-hmm. where, you know, doctors are rare. And somebody could just breathe onto this e-nose and the information could be transmitted to a doctor, you know, hundreds of miles away in a major city who could then diagnose you.
Yeah. Anna, this may be beyond your purview as a science journalist, but I'm wondering if all diseases do have smells that we just may not know yet, you know, that they may be detectable by really sensitive e-noses that we build in the future, for example.
Given the long list of smells related to diseases that I've read so far, I wouldn't be surprised if there are far more diseases that have smells than we even know about today.
Any others that you want to share with us that weren't in your video?
Sure. There's one called scrofula, which is said to smell like stale beer. It's a type of tuberculosis that I think children used to get. There are a lot of other ones that have more complicated names, like Fetor hepaticus, which is a liver disease that smells like newly mown clover.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Anna Rothschild, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Anna Rothschild is producer and host of the new digital series Gross Science, produced by WGBH and Nova. We do have a link to her video page at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Online crowdsourcing has brought us Wikipedia, thousands of review sites, and crowdfunding resources like Kickstarter. Up next, a psychologist explains how peer-to-peer technology may help ease depression and anxiety. Crowdsourcing therapy when word of mouth returns.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Remember that 2009 commercial for the iPhone? The one where the guy keeps saying,
"There's an app for that."
Now we're accustomed to the notion that there really is an app for just about everything. But we were still a little surprised to hear about this next project. Dr. Robert Morris is a psychologist working at the MIT Media Lab, and he's currently designing an app called Coco that he hopes will combat depression through online crowdsourced therapy. Robert Morris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So first of all, the type of therapy that this project relies on is called cognitive behavioral therapy. First, can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So cognitive behavioral therapy is one of our evidence-based therapies, and it's designed to treat a wide spectrum of mental health concerns, most notably depression, anxiety, but it can also be very valuable for everyday stress and really anyone who has had the human experience of daily life hassles and stressors. And the basic, you know, simple idea behind it is the idea that our thoughts influence our feelings. And oftentimes, if we really take a very rational and objective approach to our thoughts, we can see that sometimes they're a little bit unrealistic, maybe they're a little bit rigid. And the first step in cognitive behavioral therapy, and it is fairly complex, but the first step is to simply start deconstructing your thoughts and find more adaptive, more flexible, more positive ways to construe the world around you.
Mm-hmm. So how does this app do that or help one do that?
So when you're stressed, your brain's ability to think creatively and with poise tends to shut down. I think that's, you know, an experience we're often very familiar with. And so when you're suffering a stressor, you often can resort to one fairly negative, at least this happens to me, interpretation of what's going on. And it's hard to consider alternative interpretations or even objectively analyze the way you're thinking about it. And so what this app does is it recruits a whole bunch of people that are also on the app. These are all volunteers who are using the app, not necessarily therapists or trained physicians. And they're all there to help you nudge your cognition around. So if there are any bugs in your thinking, they help spot them for you. They help come up with alternative interpretations of stressful situations so that you can have a more grounded, more flexible way of managing the stresses that are upsetting you.
All right, so I get that idea. I mean, I've heard the expression that, you know, don't live inside of your own head. It's a bad neighborhood, you know, the kind of thing that you need other people to help you recognize what you're doing. But how does an app actually do that?
Well, some of the early mental health apps that used cognitive behavioral therapy would simply be psychoeducation apps. And by this, I mean you would really just read content about how your thoughts influence your feelings, how different types of thought patterns are very common, how to spot them, how to correct them, etc. And this was a very good start. The problem with these early apps was they were not particularly engaging. It was essentially asking you to sort of do homework on your own. Mm-hmm. The app I'm working on is very social. It's designed to mimic social networks such as Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, things that are powerfully engaging and designed to bring people back again and again. So you go on the app and you might write something like, okay, I have a performance review with my boss today. I walked into her office and she scowled at me and told me to go away. And I left thinking, oh my gosh, my performance review is going to be terrible. I'm going to be fired. My boss clearly hates me. This is awful. So you'd send that out to the network. The network would then help you do several things. One is it would spot these systematic bugs in your thinking. The technical term is a cognitive distortion. So they might spot something called mind reading. You're trying to read the mind of your boss, even though you probably don't know 100% what she's thinking. Then you'd have people systematically start writing different versions of that story for you that are equally plausible but less catastrophic. So they might say, well, maybe your boss is upset for other reasons that don't have anything to do with you. In a ridiculous case, she could be scowling because she ate some bad shrimp at lunch and is not feeling good. There are all sorts of stories that could be equally plausible that don't necessarily mean you're about to be fired and your boss hates you. Mm-hmm. And the idea is people in the crowd are just way better positioned to come up with these creative reinterpretations than the individual who's very stressed in the moment.
But are they? I mean, they're not trained. They could be having a bad day themselves. I mean, I'm thinking that somebody who posts something like this is in a pretty vulnerable state. Wouldn't they be kind of bait for trolls or people who want to be cruel?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point. So there are two things to say in response to that. The one is people are trained on the app. So they do go through training to systematically learn how to use these skills. And these skills are simple sounding at first, but the nuances of them are a little bit challenging. So, you know, we spent several years trying to find a way to teach these skills in a very short manner, but that would reliably educate people. The second point that you mentioned is certainly any type of online community is prone to trolling behavior or people who go on just to be malicious or cruel, unfortunately. So we do a number of different things. The first thing is we do have human moderators reading everything very quickly before it actually goes out to people. We also have a set of algorithms that we're continually refining that actually very robustly can identify bullying behavior. We have a whole corpus of what we call bullying data from other social networks that we use to train algorithms. The main point is that this is a huge part of our development process. Anytime we're making a new change to the design or reconsidering part of it, one of the first things we think about is how do we moderate it? Yes, these are individuals who may be feeling down. We need to make sure that they never get any kind of trolling experience from the app.
So I know this is in development now. Have you been able to test whether it's effective?
Yes, that was done at MIT in collaboration with Northwestern, and there's now being some additional studies at Columbia University. So the first study we did was a randomized controlled trial where we simply wanted to ask the question, does repeated use of this platform confer any psychological benefits? And we ran the randomized controlled trial and had people use either our platform for about 3 weeks or a control platform. And the control platform was something called expressive writing, which is another intervention designed to target well-being. And within that control group and that trial, we found that after 3 weeks, people who used our platform had significantly better psychological outcomes across the board. And more importantly, those who had a little bit of baseline depression improved the most. What's really exciting now is we're now starting to pinpoint what about the experience may have been contributing to these gains. Was it just being amongst people who are supporting you and empathizing with you? We don't think that's necessarily the case. We think it's more about the tools that you're practicing as you're interacting with people. And then also we have new data suggesting that the more you help other people on the app, the better your outcome is. And we're trying to determine whether that's also just a practice effect, whether it's just you rehearsing some of these evidence-based techniques, or whether there's something else about just the well-being effect of helping other people.
I guess one of the challenges, though, with a lot of depressed people is, A, recognizing that they're depressed, you know, being able to step outside of themselves far enough to recognize it as depression, and to seek help. Any ways that COCO in particular will target those people and help draw them in?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I think our goal is to innovate in a lot of ways. But one of the ways we're trying to innovate is trying to reduce the stigma, reduce the barrier to entry. One thing we do is we don't call it a depression app. And that's for a couple of reasons. Number one is these cognitive skills are valuable for anyone. So in the study, initially, it was called a stress reduction app. So everyone is very in our society seems to be okay with saying they have stress, acknowledging they have stress. They're less okay with acknowledging, you know, that they have depression, even to themselves or to the point where they're downloading an app specifically tailored for it. So one of the things we have to think about is how we message and position the app so it reaches the population that really needs it and doesn't have a barrier in terms of stigma that maybe scares people away.
Dr. Robert Morris, great to speak with you. Thank you very much and best of luck with COCO.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Morris is a psychologist currently designing a social network designed to help people, to use his term, combat stress through cognitive behavioral therapy. You can currently sign up to join the waitlisted beta version of the app. It's called COCO. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up after the break, a peek into one of the country's hidden jobs, the often stressful, sometimes prestigious, sometimes downright menial position of personal assistant to the wealthy or famous. A look at the assistant economy after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The fabled American dream travels along a well-worn path. All begin with ambitious and enterprising individuals who give it their all at a good college, then launch into the job market until they distinguish themselves in their field. Unless, of course, they choose the glittery, though frequently thankless, position of personal assistant to a class of celebrities, artists, hedge fund managers, or the other 1% of the 1%ers. Turns out there is an entire pool, code of behavior, and economy among those who dream of rubbing elbows with professionals and celebrities, although they often land in a nightmare of a dead-end job. Francesca Mari is an associate editor at Texas Monthly in Austin and contributor to Dissent magazine, where we found her article, The Assistant Economy. Francesca, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So the personal assistant is not the kind of job you typically see in wanted ads, and I'm wondering how you discovered this hidden market for assistants.
Yeah, so I was an English major in college, and when senior year rolled around and the prospect of having to support myself became a reality, I started looking at what my friends were doing, and tons of them were becoming personal assistants. So they were becoming personal assistants to writers, to politicians, to directors, to Daphne Merkin, to Karl Rove, to Darren Aronofsky, the director of The Wrestler and Black Swan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of how I heard about it.
And we should mention that you were an undergrad at Harvard, so you were at an elite university. It turns out a lot of people recruit personal assistants from the Ivy League schools. What are they looking for?
You know, I think the thing that appeals to personal assistants or to people who apply to become personal assistants is the same thing that appeals to the people seeking them, and that's status. So, you know, when you're an undergrad and you want to become a writer or an artist, there's no real entry-level job for that sort of thing. Learning from a giant seems very appealing and it seems very glamorous. So to become an assistant to Darren Aronofsky is amazing. It's a dream job. You know, if I told my dad that I was his assistant, he'd be so proud. Similarly, I think that, you know, these successful artists and writers and politicians want someone who's impressive and smart and sharp and ambitious working for them. And it's a matter of status to say that they have, you know, a great Yale grad who worships them.
Yes.
So it's a two-way street.
That's kind of the key, isn't it? That worships them and looks up to them. Distinguish, if you would, personal assistant from what we think of as an administrative assistant or a secretary kind of thing. What kind of things might a personal assistant be expected to do?
Secretary sort of denotes a dead-end typing and filing job for women. You know, it sounds like something out of the 60s. Whereas a personal assistant or administrative assistant denotes upward mobility and seems like a gender-neutral position. And so personal assistants, you know, a friend of mine became a personal assistant to Daphne Merkin, who is a very good writer and has written a lot about her struggles with mental illness. And as her assistant, you know, my friend was tasked with everything from helping edit her manuscripts to returning dead houseplants, or, you know, if she had gone on a shopping binge during one of her more manic episodes and bought, you know, 10 sweaters from Barney's, her assistant would be charged with returning many of them. It's kind of like being Nabokov's wife or Tolstoy's wife. Like, you're kind of a life support coach.
I would imagine their wives didn't have to sign non-disclosure agreements, however, you know. Discretion, yeah. I would imagine, is a key factor for somebody to be a personal assistant.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my piece, I talked a little bit about a hedge fund billionaire who solicits applicants from Harvard and sends emails to SUMA students and Phi Beta Kappa students, inviting them to apply, and is very, very cryptic about what the position is that they're applying to. But if you make it to the application round, you end up signing a very serious non-disclosure agreement. And if you get hired, you're not really allowed to say where you work, which is insane.
Hmm. And yet some people do talk about their experience. One who wrote about it, Sigrid Nunez, who was a personal assistant to Susan Sontag. Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah, so Sigrid Nunez is a great writer in her own right. And at the time, Susan Sontag was looking for someone to help her with her correspondence because Sontag had just survived a pretty intense bout of cancer and had, you know, stacks and stacks of letters that she needed to respond to. Nunez was recommended to Sontag by Sontag's editors at the New York Review of Books because they lived near one another on the Upper West Side. And Nunez respected Sontag enormously. And so the relationship was, you know, very interesting and intense. And through Sontag, she met an array of fabulous people, including the great poet Joseph Brodsky. But Nunez was deeply impacted by her relationship because the terms on which they met meant that Sontag forever viewed her as a young mentee and didn't really respect her ever as an equal. And so I think Nunez found that relationship to be somewhat obliterating. And so years after the fact has written a memoir about her experience.
There's one stinging moment where she or Sontag calls her to congratulate her for winning the Rome Prize, this absolutely prestigious prize. And what does she say? Something like, yeah, I turned it down a few years ago or something like that.
Yeah. Sontag couldn't kind of bear to see someone younger than her succeed.
Well, the title of your article is The Assistant Economy, and I'm wondering about the economy. Do people actually get paid their worth? I would imagine if you divided all the hours up for an all-access assistant, it might not come up to much.
No, I think it's a really terribly paid position. If you look at the hedge fund billionaire's personal assistant position, that is extremely well compensated because discretion is so important and because none of the people that he's hiring presumably want to work in that particular field or become a hedge fund billionaire themselves. Instead, he's attracting very brilliant artists and and musicians and writers who are a little bit lost and looking for something to do while they kind of figure out their next step. Whereas, you know, a position at the New York Review of Books is notoriously poorly paid because those kids want to become editors. They want to become writers, and that's a great stepping stone for them. And many of them go on to great careers. They move from the New York Review of Books to the New Yorker to Harper's, etc.
I'm speaking with Francesca Mari. She recently wrote an article for Dissent magazine about the hidden army of personal assistants who are employed by actors and writers and artists and hedge fund managers, and how these jobs differ from more conventional ways of starting a career. Well, Francesca, films like The Devil Wears Prada, we get the impression that being an assistant is sort of like a long hazing process after which someone who sticks with it does earn their success. Does it ever have the opposite effect, you know, maybe driving people away from a possible career?
Yeah, I think personal assistant-boss relationships are like any relationship, and there are good ones and there are bad ones, and I'm thinking of John Irving's personal assistant, who is a wonderful writer and a teacher now, and who loved the Irvings. They were very supportive of her. Most of her tasks involved, you know, typing up his manuscript pages. So every day he would write by hand 25 or so pages and leave them on her seat, and she would type them up. And John Irving is dyslexic. And so a lot of her job would be correcting spelling and so on, and then handing him the pages. And as soon as he got those pages, he would read over them and begin editing. And she watched the process through which his stories were created and saw just, you know, the dogged hours that he put into it. She herself wanted to be a writer, and the Irvings were super supportive. They gave her time off to attend the Breadloaf Writers Conference. But she was also kind of exposed to such a great writer that she was intimidated, and ultimately she decided that she didn't have what it took to be, you know, the level of writer that she wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And so she became a teacher.
Okay, so that's a good story. How about anyone tell you absolutely not? I mean, they just ran screaming from these positions?
I'm sure there are a number of assistants to Scott Rudin, since he's gone through 250 of them, that just ran the other direction and never looked back.
250?
Yeah. He only fizzes up to some 100 or so because he doesn't count those who don't survive his two-week trial period.
So what might be the future job prospects for a personal assistant? You know, an ideal next step?
So I think the professions that have personal assistants, there's no clear career path, and that's why ambitious kids take on these roles that are somewhat secretarial. You know, a personal assistant never advances to become the person that they assist. There's no clear promotion. So I think what people hope for is to make a connection with someone during this position, or to develop a mentorship with their boss. And in that regard, the status of your employer determines your success more than the skill level required of your position. And there have been IMDb longitudinal studies that show that. You know, so Noah Baumbach's assistant left when the film that he was working on wrapped, Margot at the Wedding, and he became an assistant to a professor of his at SVA, who was a film critic. And then after that, he made his own movie. And he passed that movie off to Noah Baumbach, asking for, you know, feedback. I think the hope is that Baumbach would see the movie, love it, and it would go somewhere. He would, you know, put in a word or put him in touch with something. In this particular instance, Noah Baumbach never responded.
Hmm. It reminds me of the, you know, the Lana Turner sitting there at Schwab's drugstore sipping a milkshake, you know, getting discovered. This whole idea that if you are in the proximity of someone famous, you will be discovered for the talents and special gifts that you have. What do you think? Is this is this a new American dream?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think that's what's kind of peculiar about the personal assistant position, is that those who make the most of it are those who are the most socially apt. It's not the hardest workers or the most creative. It's the people who have sort of the social skills, the manners, the kind of trappings of class, or these cultural, shared cultural references, who are really able to parlay the position and the proximity to someone great into something that works out for them.
after spending some time writing about this, would you ever recommend to somebody to take a job as a personal assistant?
Yeah, actually, if the person you're assisting is great or a kind person, then I think it can be a really worthwhile experience and mentorship. But it's kind of like asking, you know, could you recommend X date Y? You know, you have to know what Y is like.
Francesca Mari, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Francesca Mari, she's associate editor at Texas Monthly based in Austin. She's also a contributor to Dissent magazine. And you'll find her article from Dissent, The Assistant Economy, at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast awaits you. You can also sign up by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review, pass it on, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.